Thank you all for tuning in to BBS Radio. Beginning today, we have Emmy Award-winning TV producer, investigative journalist, and reporter and editor of EarthFiles.com, Linda Moulton Howe. She will periodically bring EarthFile news to TNT Radio and BBS Radio. EarthFiles.com has received Encyclopedia Britannica Award for Internet Excellence and the Web Association's Award for Internet Standard of Excellence. EarthFiles is a crossroads where experts, eyewitnesses, and viewers meet to share the latest updates in Earth and astronomical mysteries, plus real X-Files. Linda Moulton Howe's in-depth reports go beyond the 6 o'clock news. She goes directly to the men and women at the forefront of science and environmental challenges and to firsthand eyewitnesses of high strangeness. Today, she begins with a real X-File about the huge, unidentified boomerangs people have seen all over the world. Listeners can view a map and drawings about her up-to-date today at Linda's February 25th Earth Files. Just go to www.earthfiles.com. Scroll down to February 25th and click on the hot link to Huge Boomerang Craft and Blonde Beings. This is the first time Linda has heard the intelligence inside the boomerangs could be the tall blonde entities which people in the human abduction syndrome have called Swedes or Nordics. In the last half hour, we will take your live phone calls at 888-268-4313. Again, the toll-free number to call and ask Linda questions after her news update is 888-268-4313. Here now from Albuquerque, New Mexico, is Earth Files reporter and editor Linda Moulton Howe.
Thank you, Don. In the early to mid-1980s, more than 5,000 people living in the Hudson Valley of New York and in Connecticut and along the East Coast reported in the sky huge boomerang-shaped craft. Descriptions of the size was as big as 3 football fields, said one eyewitness. A flying city, said another. According to East Coast investigators who studied the sighting statistics, including the famous astronomer J. Allen Hynek, nearly half of the aerial craft were the shape of boomerangs. The next largest category were triangles. And everyone said the huge, low-flying objects were completely silent. Newspaper investigator Robert Pratt reported, quote, on the night of July 24, 1984, 12 security guards watched as a boomerang-shaped object hovered for more than 10 minutes directly above one of the nuclear reactors of the Indian Point Nuclear Power Plant. That's located on the Hudson River at Buchanan, 20 miles north of Manhattan. It was so large that one police officer had to pan a security camera on the plant's roof for 180 degrees to take in the whole object in the sky. Inside the security console, the computer that controlled all the security and communication systems at the nuclear power plant shut down. The incident was so shocking that the commander contacted a nearby National Guard unit and asked that a helicopter be sent to shoot the object down. Before the action could be carried out, whatever this huge boomerang UFO was moved away. Later, authorities denied anything happened, unquote. For at least 5 years, whatever intelligence was inside the huge unidentified boomerangs, those objects could move freely over regions of the United States without any American military interference. Who was inside of those boomerangs? Now, for the first time, comes a report to me from a 63-year-old woman named Chris, who remembers in the fall of 1982 that she watched a huge boomerang over Norfolk, Virginia, at the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay. It was about 8:30 p.m. after a restaurant dinner with her friend Terry. The two women were heading to a friend's house, passing near the Norfolk Beach, when they realized everything around them was suddenly very quiet.
We had just passed the fire station. The doors were open. The lights were on. There were trucks in there, but no people. And there were no people on the street, no dogs, no cars. It was the quietest quiet I've ever heard in the area. It was just, the only thing I heard was a very faint lapping of the water up on the beach. And we were about a block from the water, and I saw this black hole in the sky. It was obliterating everything, you know. And I stopped the car, and we got out. That's when I noticed how quiet it was when we got out of the car. We were standing in the middle of the street looking up at this thing. It was boomerang-shaped, totally black, no lights whatsoever. And as we were looking at it, a ball of light, it looked from where we were standing, it looked about the size of a basketball. And it shot out of the curve in the boomerang, the card of the boomerang, so fast. It was a ball of fire. It shot out of there so fast that if you had blinked, you would have missed it. And at that point, the craft pivoted about 90 degrees and headed out over the water so slow that I could have walked underneath it and followed it. But when I initially saw it, it was hovering. There was no sound. It was perfectly still. And after it shot out that ball of light, it pivoted and headed out across the water toward Norfolk. Mm-hmm. We got in the car, and we were stunned.
Do you have any idea how big it was?
It was huge. It was like a block and a half wide, you know, and then the body of it was thick, you know. It was a boomerang shape, and the body of it, at the nose of the boomerang, was thick. It made not one single whisper of a sound, nothing. I mean, and it was just so quiet, it was like somebody had thrown a blanket of silence over the area, except for that lapping of the water. And it was more like a lake than you would expect. I don't know if you look on the map, you'll see that Hampton is kind of right at the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, only set back.
Mm-hmm.
So we got in the car, and I asked Carrie, I said, "Did you see what I just saw?" And she said, "Yeah." And I said, no. I said, "Tell me what you saw." So she told me, and she told me about the ball of light and everything. And I said, because I thought, I didn't know what to think, you know. So we got in a car, and we drove on to my friend Foster's house, where we were going to spend the night and then go over to my stepfather's the next day. We walked in the door, and he said, "I thought you girls said you were coming home early." And I said, "Well, Foster, it is early. I mean, you know, it can't be more than 8:45 or 9 o'clock at the most. I mean, you know, all we did was have dinner and a couple of drinks." It turned out it was after 11, the local news was on. I noticed at the time. I said, "What's the news doing on?" And he said, "Well, it always comes on at this time of night." And I said, "Well, we left Jack's at 8:30 on the way home, Carrie, and I had decided we weren't going to say anything to anybody about any of this, you know, because they just think we were nuts or drunk." I looked at Terry, and she looked at me, and I said, "Well, should we tell him?" You know, because he was really put out that we had stayed out that late, and he had been expecting us earlier. So we told him what we had seen. And he said, "Oh, you're drunk." And I looked at her and I said, "What did I tell you? Over the years, I have remembered at least, I think, most of what happened during that missing time.
Okay.
Okay. Now, I don't know if Terry was aboard the ship or not, or the craft, or whatever it was, because I didn't see her there. But I found myself aboard. I don't remember how I got there. And the first thing I did, the first thing I remember saying to them was, if I cooperate with you, will you do something for me?
Yeah.
So they asked me.
But what are you looking at?
Well, I'm looking at these tall, I'm very short. I'm 5'2", and it's a little difficult for me to tell height, but I did date a guy that was 6'4", and these people were at least his height,
mm-hmm.
maybe a little bit taller,
mm-hmm.
but right around that. Not 7 or 8 feet or anything like that, you know, really nothing out of the ordinary. I mean, they were a little bit extraordinary, but it's not something that you would be astonished to see walking down the street, you know.
Okay.
The
yeah.
hair was very, very blonde, light blonde, and kind of sparse.
Was it long or short?
It was kind of a little below shoulder length, but not real long.
Page boy or straight?
Straight.
Bangs?
I don't remember bangs. I think it was combed to the side or pushed to the side.
The color of the skin?
Very pale. And very, very blue eyes.
If you were comparing the blue to something I might know, what would it be?
Bluer than the sky.
Darker?
Yeah, a little bit.
Right.
Not much.
Okay.
And
are the eyes the same size as human or bigger or smaller?
About the same, maybe a little bit bigger, but it's not startlingly bigger.
Are you looking at round pupils? Are you looking at cat eyes? What are you looking at?
Round pupils.
Okay. What about the nose, the mouth, cheekbones, eyebrows?
High cheekbones. The faces were long and thin, but not, like I'm saying, it's not so out of the ordinary that they would stand out like a light coming on or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
There was one feature that I noticed is that their arms were long, very long. Like when I stand up and put my arms to my side, my fingertips just kind of cover the top of my thigh a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And if they were standing up with their arms drooping down, the fingertips would come to just maybe 3 or 4 inches above the knee.
Mm-hmm. So very long arms.
Very long arms and long, thin hands, long, thin fingers.
Did you notice nails?
Yes, they had fingernails.
Okay. And now the legs and the feet.
Oh, gosh. They had on kind of like this, kind of like a cross between a robe and a toga or something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't get a look at the feet or the legs.
What was the color of the toga?
They were dressed in white.
Okay. Was there any insignia or patch or anything?
No, I couldn't see anything like that.
Okay. Now, how many are in front of you?
There were two.
Are they male or female?
I think they're one male and one female.
And you judge it as female because?
The voice or the thought voice or the thought impression. What? I'm not sure whether I ever spoke or it all took place mentally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not sure.
And what were the first impressions of thoughts in your head?
Well, I thought I was kind of dumbstruck that I had always known from when I can remember riding in the car as a little child, and my mother would pack back seat level with the window of the car, and I'd lay there and I'd look out at the sky, and I always knew something was there. Some others were there. I just knew it.
Well, what did they communicate to you?
I asked them. I said, "Well, if I cooperate with you, what will you do for me?" And they said, "Well, what do you want?" You know. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, I always wanted to be the first woman off the planet." I said, "But I missed that by quite a few years." Mm-hmm. I said, "But I would still like to go place besides Earth." So, no problem. And the next thing I know, a part of the wall became transparent, a big part, like 10 or 11 feet tall by 18 or 19 feet wide. And it looked just like the stars, you know, just stars out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Oh, wait a minute now. This could be a projection.
Mm-hmm.
How do I know that I'm looking at space?" I said, "I want to go somewhere where I can get out."
Mm-hmm.
And unbelievably, they took me somewhere.
Where?
It's a planet. I presume it to be in this galaxy, though I can't certify that. When I got out, I was near a body of water. It looked purple. The sand looked pink. The ambient light was good, but it was like a twilight. If I were facing north to the east, there was a binary star off in the far distance, of course, but it looked big from where I was.
Meaning like you were seeing two suns?
Yes, like I was seeing a large sun with a small sun circulating around it.
Mm-hmm.
And at first I thought, this is the sun that this planet goes around. And I leapt up into the air, and I rose off the ground about 8 feet. My feet were off the ground about 8 feet, and I gently drifted back down to the sand, which was pink. And there was some kind of grass growing out of the sand back away from the water a little ways. It was very, very coarse and hard. Very dark, dark green. And to the west, I saw this light over the horizon. And I said, "Oh, I want to go there." You know, I thought it was a city,
right?
Or a settlement or something like that. And they said, "No, you can't go there." And as I've thought about it over the years, and I've retrieved these memories over all these years, I think perhaps that may have been the sun the planet was orbiting around, and I was actually looking at the night sky.
Right.
So I'm not sure about that.
Did they say anything about the planet?
No, they didn't tell me anything about it, except that they wouldn't let me stay for very long. They made me. We had to go. And so we did. And
when you're back in their craft, what is around you in terms of the walls, the floor, and the ceiling?
Okay, when I was on a deck that had that transparent side or panel on it.
Mm-hmm.
they could make it look solid or they could make it transparent. And, but I also have a recollection of a room that was metallic, like stainless steel, whether it was stainless steel or not, I have no idea. I didn't see any instruments. I saw a table, like about the size of a gurney. And I don't remember any experiments being done on me or any kind of probing being done on me. My agreement with them was that at some point in time, a time of their choosing, that I would allow myself to be impregnated and have the fetus retrieved.
Mm-hmm.
That was the deal I made with them.
Chris is not the only person in the human abduction syndrome who has reported feeling as if the genetic material, whether eggs or sperm, is part of some kind of either deal, pre-negotiation, something that is the reason for people to be taken in what is called the human abduction syndrome in the first place. A genetic harvest that may end up in the production of what may be hybrids. There is another case that has been focused on the pregnancy of a woman, of a husband and wife, that they both consciously remembered the beam of light coming down around their car. This was in Colorado in 1980, again back at that somewhat similar period of time. And it's a very dramatic case. Many drawings. I was involved in the investigation of it for 2 years with a social scientist in Boulder, Colorado, and I featured it in some depth in my first book called An Alien Harvest. And without going into all of the details of that extraordinary experience, the woman did not know that she was pregnant at the time of the abduction. And in fact, the issue came up. Could the abduction have been to impregnate her? This is a mystery in a lot of people's lives, and today I have kept in touch with that couple since the early 80s. I saw them just a couple of years ago, and the child who was born out of that pregnancy that might have been linked to that abduction is a young man now who is gifted mentally. His whole focus is in biochemistry. He is considered to be a near genius. And unfortunately, like so many people in the human abduction syndrome, they do not want anybody to know who they are, where they are, and the last thing that the parents want is for even their son to know anything about what happened to them in November of 1980. And yet, he is an extraordinary and gifted human contributing to the planet today. Now, in their case, the people that they described or entities they described in the Colorado case, they were the more classic extraterrestrial biological entity that is described in our own government's top secret classified documents that have been leaked to a few of us as being about 5 feet tall, gray skinned, with very large eyes and not human looking. Some people refer to them as grays. The government refers to them as EBENs, an acronym for extraterrestrial biological entities. What I think is so important about the Chris case, and she also does not want to be identified, what her real name is, where she lives, because everybody is afraid of being attacked by other humans and criticized. She is, in my estimation, having talked with maybe 800 to 1,000 people over the last 26 years in this whole area of human abduction, she is, as far as I can tell, extremely honest, extremely humble, and extremely affected by what happened to her and that boomerang experience in Norfolk, Virginia in the fall of 1982. And the fact that she's the first and only person
out of almost 1,000 people that I have talked to and interviewed over the years who has ever linked the boomerang shape to the so-called blondes, Nordics, or Swedes, I find very, very interesting, and especially because I am now going to share in this first Earth Files report for BBS my own eyewitness sighting of one of these huge boomerangs. It was back in November of 1986, which was only 4 years after Chris's experience. I was in Denver, Colorado. The time was about 6 p.m. in the evening. And in Denver, where I was living at the time, 6 o'clock in November, essentially you have a twilight sky with some stars. The big Rocky Mountains are still silhouetted black. And I was coming out of a bank building where I had been doing editing in a production office in my work as a TV producer. And as I was coming out of the bank into the parking lot, my car was maybe 50, 60 feet away. I was looking to the silhouette of the mountains, and there was a very thin first moon, that first thin, thin crescent moon, hanging in the twilight sky over the mountains. And I remember in my mind thinking, oh, how beautiful. That was the only thought. It was just astonishingly beautiful. And at that moment, after thinking that thought, walking through the cars in the parking lot and carrying my briefcase, which was on a very long leather handle, so that the briefcase was down to my waist and the rest was the strap, something, and to this day I cannot tell you what, something made me spin so fast that the briefcase swung out from my shoulder on its strap and hit a car. I remember feeling that, feeling the thud and hearing it. And instead of looking behind me as if somebody was coming up behind me, I realized that I spun looking straight up. And above me, blocking out most of the sky above me, was a huge boomerang. And it was so astonishing that the first thought I remember in my mind couldn't place the shape of a boomerang, and so my mind in those first hundredths of a second was, where is the fuselage? Where is the fuselage? And I kept staring at it, trying to see the shape of a normal plane and having to accept that what I was looking at was the shape of a boomerang. But it wasn't like a boomerang that would be thrown in Australia. This looked like five stories. Like if you took 2 5-story hotels and you brought them together on an angle that formed the V at the front of the boomerang, and then you brought those 5 stories down, slightly narrowing them for a very long distance to what looked like at the end, quartz crystals, faceted quartz crystals. And I don't mean glistening like a crystal. I mean the shape of crystals at the end, but the entire color, and I assume that it was from all of the tall lights in the bank building parking lot because this was so low, there was no light visible that I could see, but there was structure all over this thing. And the color, it always, in my mind, the only thing I have ever seen on the earth that would come close to the color that I was looking at would be something like a bronze sculpture, kind of brown with a touch of maybe a touch of gold in the brown, but essentially that kind of a dark color. And every piece of it had structure. To this date in my life on this planet, I have never seen anything in the air that was 100% covered by structure. And when I say that, it is hard to find the English words because I was looking at shapes that did not resemble any geometric shapes or any other kind of shapes that I have ever seen on this planet. And I remember the feeling like being a little child and looking at something with complete awe, my eyes and my mind just struggling to place some kind of comprehension about this enormous thing in the sky that had shapes all over it. understand that seemed to be so big that it would be like two five-story hotel buildings in the front tapering to these crystal-looking facets. And then it dawned on me that it was completely silent. Anything this huge, blocking most of the sky above me, so close that I could see all of this structure and I could hear zero. And then it dawned on me, because for a second I looked around, there was not another person in that bank parking lot at 6 p.m. in November of 1986 that I could see in any direction. It was just me and this gigantic thing above me. That makes no sense. That's not logical. A bank building, six block, a large parking lot full of cars. There should have been people everywhere. I cannot explain that. I know that I observed it. As this thing continued to move, it was moving so slowly that you would think of impossible that anything that large could just creep in the sky with no sound. And the last that I saw of it was literally because I watched it for so long that it dissolved into the twilight darkness. That's what it seemed to do. Well, when I finally came back to my senses and got in my car and drove to my home office in Littleton, Colorado, the very first thing I did was go to a desk and try to the best of my ability to write down immediately, sketch what it was that I saw, and realize I couldn't because I didn't know what I was drawing. I did not, could not relate to the pattern. So the next thing I did, I called John Andrews in San Diego. He was working for the Testor Corporation, and John Anderson, God bless him, passed on a couple of years ago, but for many, many years, it was John Andrews who courageously was building models based on leaked confidential information from people in the aerospace industry, and they were delighted when they could get out some model through Testor that tweaked the nose of the government, so to speak, that they had inside information and had models on things before they were ever publicly released. And one of those was the B-1 bomber. John Anderson knew everything about the B-1 bomber before it was ever trotted out publicly. Well, I called John. I explained what I've just explained to you. John, have I just seen the B-1 bomber? And he quietly laughed. And he said, Linda, no. The B-1 bomber is as smooth as glass. It is a planform, meaning subtly soft curving. There is not any structure, no 3D structure on it. And everything I was looking at in this gigantic thing had three-dimensional structures all over it. Every floor, if you want to call them floors, of those two big hotel-looking buildings at the front of the boomerang tapering down to these facets. And I said, do you know of anything that is being done in aerospace that would have at the end of it, at the end of the wings or at the end of the fuselage or at the end of anything that looked exactly like quartz crystals, but they were all the same color? And he said, you are describing something to me that I have never heard of in my life. This is John Andrews at Testor. And he said, how high do you think it was above you? And I said, well, I was seeing all of this structure, and I don't know. I couldn't hear any sound. And he said, if it was 500 feet above you, and he did a calculation, it might be, and it was a huge dimension, like two or three football fields wide, which would be like the people on the East Coast had described back in the early 80s in the Connecticut Hudson Valley. And he said if it was 1,000 feet above you, and it was as big as you're describing, having to put your arms above your head and extend them out at least 3 feet, he said this could have been an object that was a couple of 1,000 feet in diameter, which would be the size of the gigantic triangle that flew over Phoenix, Arizona on March 13th, 1997. This was the most important part of the March 13th, 1997 event over Arizona and Phoenix, and not often delineated. Most people remember the videotape of the bow of lights, but earlier in the evening, at least half a dozen people saw this object in the twilight, and they were professionals, and the people estimated the length of the object over Phoenix on March 13, 1997, as being at least 1,800 feet long, which is close to the 2,000 feet that John Andrews was telling me that this object above me might have been if it were only 1,000 feet above me. I'm sharing this today in my first Earth Files report on BBS Radio in hopes that it might help others listening who have had experiences like this and have never come forward because they are afraid of criticism. And I can assure you that I have been an investigative reporter and TV producer now for a quarter of a century, and I have always respected the confidentiality of everyone. I am happy to interview people either on or off the record, and I am also happy to use a pseudonym, a different name without identity, as I have done with Chris today, about her extraordinary experience with another huge boomerang over Norfolk, Virginia in the end of October to early November of 1982. I think that one of the big values that I, as a reporter and a TV producer, can bring through my news reports and my news website, earthfiles.com, are experiences like this that might give us some insight eventually to part of what we are dealing with in what our own government calls extraterrestrial biological entities, now in leaked documents, so clear that our government has had knowledge about multiple types of entities for decades. I am especially intrigued by what is called by the people in the human abduction syndrome, Nordics or Swedes. They are the most enigmatic. They have come up in other extraordinary cases that I have documented in depth with many drawings, multiple cases in my two-volume book, Glimpses of Other Realities. The first volume is called Facts and Eyewitnesses. The second volume is called High Strangeness. There is a very large section by a variety of people who have had some encounters with these tall Nordics or Swedes, as they call them, because they are tall, light-skinned, blue-eyed, and blonde-haired. But who are they? What is their relationship to the gray Ebens that are so commonly described in other abductions? Are they in association with each other? Or, as it's been suggested to me by government insiders, that there's conflict? If there is conflict between two or more different intelligences interacting with this Earth, what is their agenda? And what are the implications for us, Homo sapiens surface life on this planet, today and into the future? These are the questions that I am struggling in my work as an investigative reporter to keep trying to find bits of information and share it with you, the public, because I think that we all have a right to know about other intelligences from someplace else in the universe interacting with this planet for decades or perhaps centuries, or even, as one man told me from the Defense Intelligence Agency, we are dealing with at least two species that have been involved with planet Earth for 250 million years. Homo erectus did not start until about 1.5 to 2 million years ago. The size and scope of this particular real X-Files, the issue of humans, our Earth, and other intelligences interacting with it, I think is one of the biggest stories that anyone could possibly be dealing with, and that I hope that those of you listening will come to Earth Files News at BBS Radio as I periodically report not only about real X-Files, but in upcoming shows in April, specifically on April 8th and on April 22nd. I'm going to be bringing to you the latest and I think some of the most important news having to do with the rapid meltdown of ice on this planet that is contributing to sea level rise, And if Katrina was a huge problem in 2005, it may be only a prelude to what will be happening on coastlines around this planet as we keep evolving into this century. Another story that is huge and developing and spreading rapidly is bird flu. I have an amazing interview with the leading virologist in Europe about his own puzzlement. He uses the term bafflement at the rate with which the H5N1 virus has been spreading through birds and animals from Asia to Africa, the Middle East, and now in Europe. And the next big question, migratory birds start reaching Alaska in North America later this month of March. How long will it be before we hear that H5N1 is on the shores of North America and the United States? That will be upcoming on Earth Files in April. And now, Don, I'm curious what might be at the top of your list of questions about what I've presented today.
You know, Linda, that was truly amazing. I mean, I'm stunned. The experience you gave and the information you gave, because I'm really a UFO alien buff, have been for quite some time. And I've had some very, very strange experiences. But I wanted to ask you a question or two about this. You're saying you saw that boomerang craft. It was right above you, right?
Right.
Did you, you know, because I remember when I was out and I saw a craft above me, it was really strange because when I stepped into a certain spot, I had this feeling of lightness, and it was like being too drunk. I mean, if you were to say anything, it would be similar to being euphorically drunk. You're feeling a little dizzy, disoriented, light, not tingly or anything, but really heavily medicated, euphorically.
Well, Don, what was the shape of the object above you?
The shape was a circular. It was, no, not really circular, more oval with, let me see if I can try to give you an impression of it. Circular at one end and angular at the other. More of like the shape, almost like the shape of a boat.
Yes. And that goes directly back to real photographs. I have these at Earth Files. This was photographed by a photographer. I have interviewed him in Phoenix, Arizona, and guess when? 1947, July 8th. This was only a couple of days after the crash retrieval episodes between Roswell, White Sands, and Alamogordo, in which three craft defined by our government as interplanetary, described in our government's own documents as celestial.
Right.
Described in our government's own documents as planforms from outer space. Three objects came down between July 4th and July 6th, 1947. I, Bob, and Ryan Wood and others now have many, many leaked documents about this, and I am convinced that's the fact, not just the Roswell Corona case, not the Project Mogul Balloon, which is the Air Force's official explanation.
Right.
Which is absolutely ludicrous. Three different vehicles, and they were referred to, Don, as wedge-shaped.
Yes.
Planform wedges. What
yes.
happened over Phoenix 2 days later on July 8th? This man steps out of his house, sees this unbelievable object in the sky, which at the time he said, think of a horseshoe, but make it solid and make it curved at the end. That's the way he was stumbling to try to explain.
Right,
your
right.
description of a boat is very good. And he ran in, got his camera, took these photographs, and he knew the editor of the newspaper. And he took his camera down and said, I have just seen something bizarre and have photographed it.
Right.
And they processed the film, I believe, that very afternoon. They put it in the Arizona Republic newspaper. It has been there. It's historic. It is definite. The photographs are there. And those were the shapes of what had crashed.
Amazing.
And these other three locations, which is very similar to what you're describing. And that shape, to the best of my knowledge, that wedge-shaped shape is related to the what the government calls extraterrestrial biological entities, or the gray types,
right,
with the black slanted eyes.
Oh, wow. Okay. Now the rest of my story is going to make sense.
Completely different. Completely different.
Yes.
From the tall, blue-eyed critics in these other shapes that include, apparently, the boomerang, but more classically, the we'll call them the shape like a top, a child's top,
right,
with three balls underneath the top. That is the classic shape that is linked to the Nordic or the Swede type.
Well, I know that on this, I mean, because when I stepped out, it was almost like when you're under it, you feel that, have that weird sensation. And as soon, I mean immediately, when you step over, like if you were to draw a circle, step in and out, the feeling goes away, then you step in. Because I did this, stepped in, had the feeling, stepped out, it was gone, stepped in, had the feeling. It was just so strange that I just kept doing it over and over because it's hard to make sense of why you're.
Do you have any missing time?
You know, I don't know. It was late. I was out near a lake out near the woods, and I don't remember because I went home and went to bed. But the reason I'm saying it makes sense is because during that episode, I had, there was a flash of light earlier that came out of the sky towards the tree line. So that's kind of why I went to investigate it. And it looked like this door had come down from midway from the sky and was spiraling, but it was all ablaze with white light. And the strange part was, and now don't get me wrong, this may just be my mind being affected. I do not know. But as I was walking, I saw an entity like you described, but it's a little different. I saw an entity glide down and hover over me. It was semi-solid. It had like a greenish, what I could tell, greenish jumpsuit of some form or another, short dark hair, big eyes. But it looked human. So I, you know, and the reason I know that I wasn't, I mean, I can almost be certain I wasn't dreaming this up, because when I went and stared right up at it, it stared right back at me, positioned its face to look right into my eyes, and it was a little spooky.
Well, another thing that comes to mind about this, and it's hard to tell whether you were dealing with a humanoid shape that would be the gray type, or a Nordic type, or there's been everything from reptilian to insectoids. I mean, when you start getting into the human abduction syndrome, you really get into a lot of strange types.
Oh, yeah.
And it's hard to understand. But one of the things that you have described that I think is a common denominator in this high strangeness of interaction between humans and something that is not human is being able to step in and out of zones of different reality. And the first person who ever wrote about this with exquisite detail was John Keel. And he wrote a series of books, one of the most important, Our Haunted Planet. And in that book, he talked about his own experience when he was out investigating the Mothman.
Right.
And he did a Mothman prophecy book. Keel's done lots of very important work. And he, in that particular part of the East Coast, he was out and he was walking and everything was normal.
Right.
And suddenly, with one footstep, he felt complete terror. And the terror was so swift and overwhelming, it made him jump. It made him jump backwards.
Wow.
When he jumped backwards, he no longer felt the terror.
Yeah.
So he walked forward again. And as his foot stepped, he wasn't seeing anything. He wasn't seeing any demarcation line, but he could step into terror and step back out of terror. And he did this several times the way you're describing.
Right.
And he talked about these zones of fear that were associated in the presence of whatever the complicated UFO phenomenon is.
Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, everybody has these it was extremely interesting stories, but they like mine does match up in some respects and not in others with some of these stories. I keep having this feeling that we must be dealing with not just one or two main entities that are visiting, but I would have a sort of guess that there's, there's got to be more than 10, 20 that are...
Well, I'll tell you something. I can say that I've at least seen with my eyes, even though I was not given it to keep. It was allegedly an official government document.
Right.
It had allegedly been put together in the early 80s. It was a list of 9 different extraterrestrial biological entities.
That
was the context within which this list was written.
Yeah.
It said about one of them that they were humanoid, that they had a suntanned looking skin.
Yes, that's kind of what I saw. Exactly. Suntanned.
Okay.
Yes.
And that the suntanned skin had no hair.
No.
That eyes did have coverings, dark coverings, that they did wear leotard-like suits. Now, this is the kicker. It said, as far as our government knew, these humanoids were from the galaxy Andromeda.
Andromeda, right.
And I remember reading that and thinking, how in the world would humans on Earth in this solar system in the Milky Way galaxy ever have any way to objectively verify a statement that humanoids standing in front of us who told
right.
us either verbally or telepathically that they were from the Andromeda galaxy.
Right.
Humans, until we can travel from here to Andromeda, to Orion, to all of the constellation systems and galaxies, we will never, think about this, we humans will never have the ability to have objective truth reality.
I agree.
About anything said to us by intelligences from somewhere else in the universe. We would have to take their word.
That's right.
And coming to that, I have had several men who have worked for intelligence and in the military tell me on a variety of time periods in a variety of parts of this country, they have said, we know that the grays lie. Okay.
Yes.
Now, you could have advanced intelligence that could be involved with life seeding on this planet, that they may have been our progenitors from the beginning. They may have been the progenitors of all of the seeding of life on Earth.
Right.
I'm not saying that I know that. I'm saying this is a possibility. This has been speculated upon by biologists, by medical people, by Crick and Watson, who got the Nobel Prize for discovering the shape of DNA.
Right.
They speculated in a brilliant paper that was published in Icarus after they won the Nobel Prize that there was a likelihood, based on the fact that there was only one DNA pattern on this entire Earth for every life form, that it did not make sense that everything started from a soup
right.
in one particular ocean.
Right.
That it made more sense that that what is called panspermia, the planting of the seed of life from outside to the Earth. This is from the people who won a Nobel Prize for studying DNA. That was their speculation.
Yes.
Now, if you have the gray beings on one side, you have the blonde beings on another, you come to the intriguing question that if the Earth was seeded, did one or both do the seeding? Have multiple types done seeding? Is that why there is interest in Earth life? And if we are talking about more than a billion years or a quarter of a billion years, then we humans are so babyish. We're such babies
right.
in relationship to what could be here seeding and manipulating life, that when somebody in the military and the intelligence says to me, we know that the grays lie, I have to stand back from that and say, if you are scientists in a laboratory, you're not letting your lab rats know what you're doing. And if things come to a point where the scientists in the laboratory and the rats down in the maze finally have some periods to communicate, those scientists are still not going to tell the rats in the maze what they're doing.
Well, that's
but
right.
But they might feed some information that would be germane to what those rats in the maze they wanted them to do.
Right.
Now, if the situation is like that today in 2006, 21st century on the Earth, humans are beginning to wake up to the fact that the universe is far stranger than anybody imagined. Quantum physics is extending us now to at least 11 dimensions, probably, in string theory. Well, how much longer is it going to be before one of these intelligences acts independently from our government's strict policy of denial in the interest of national security? That's what we're living in. This government decided during the FDR and Truman administrations, yes, we know that we have interplanetary visitors, but nobody is to know. This is a serious business. This could threaten the entire economic, social, religious structure of the planet, and we are slamming the lid down on here. Serious penalties for anybody who has knowledge and who leaks. And here we are, 60-some years later, a policy of denial still in effect.
Yes.
But, Don, how much longer can it go on with human political control of such a vast secrecy and lie? When will something from outer space finally act independently? And if they don't, that means the secret policy of denial that the human governments have put in motion seems to do work for these non-humans.
That's not a good thought. Yes, that's not a good thought.
And these are some of the questions, as I do Earth Files at BBS Radio, I will continue trying to bring whatever's the latest news, not just in Real X Files, but in the whole absolute amazing world of science mysteries, Earth mysteries, and what's happening in our environment.
Well, I must say, I am just delighted to have you with BBS Radio. Just a magnificent report. It's, you know, to hear reports like this and to even try to wrap your mind around it, it's an incredible task because so much is occurring. And I think this secrecy is about to end. I think we're not far from this, the ending of this secrecy. But, you know, that's just a guess on my part. It's just amazing that there is so much happening now and so many visitations and so many sightings all over the world. And it seems to be coming to a head or a buzz. And why that is.
The world itself seems to be more chaotic. And I hope that you and all of our listeners will go to www.earthfiles.com to keep up with the latest in all these categories. Make earthfiles.com your homepage on your computer. Many people do and thank me for the news that they are getting at Earth Files that they're not getting on the 6 o'clock.
Well, thank you, Linda. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Linda Moulton Howe, Earth Files reporter and editor. Do go to www.earthfiles.com. Check it out. You're going to love it. Thank you so much, Linda. And
and I'll see you back on April 8th.
Excellent. Thank you again. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.